Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. Getting cancer as a kid is very different than as an adult. Children who have to miss months of school because of cancer treatments are more likely to fall behind their peers. They can develop anxiety, depression, feelings of isolation. Some also develop a strengthened sense of identity and a deep sense of compassion. The type of treatment, whether it's chemo or radiation, the age of the diagnosis, whether the kid's a baby or a teen, all influence the outcome. So how might cancer affect a kindergarten or a preteen? What does research really show about post-traumatic stress for survivors and for their families? And which therapies are most effective for handling fear and anxiety? My guest today is Shannon Popito. She's a clinical psychologist at Baylor's Sammons Cancer Center. Our conversation is part of KERA's Breakthroughs series, Growing Up After Cancer. There will be a screening of the PBS documentary, Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies, on March 19th at KERA. You can RSVP at KERA.org. Shannon Popito, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So let's start off with the big question. How is getting cancer as a kid different from getting cancer as an adult?
Well, it's multifaceted in so many different dimensions, and specifically just to be looking at the different ages and stages of where a young child is, whether they get diagnosis at the age of 3 or they're diagnosed at 5 or 10. All of those developmental stages factor into how they take up their cancer experience cognitively, psychosocially, even spiritually, and how they find their way in the world from the cancer and beyond it. So it's different in the sense that the brains are developing at an early age, and so cognitively they take up cancer differently. But also as a young child moves into early adolescence, hormones and bodily changes also affect a person's sense of identity and who they are with their cancer experience.
What are the common fears you see come up with kids who've gone through chemo or a bone marrow transplant, for example?
So I'm not a child psychologist, but as an adult psychologist, what I often see are people that they're struggling with the fears of what ifs. What if this little pain in my arm or this pain in my stomach is something that's more than what I expected? Maybe it's cancer. Maybe it's coming back. And so the fears are pain related. What if I die from this? What if I lose my hair and then I can't go to prom? What if this keeps me back from going on my school trip that I wanted to go on? There's all these different fears that factor in. How is this going to affect my family and my big brother? And all of these things that go through children's minds really impact how they take up their cancer experience.
Now, the types of fears that kids have during cancer treatment really, really ranges. And like you said, it depends a lot on the age. Margaret Strand was just 3 when she was diagnosed with ALL, and this is her fear.
My name is Margaret Strand, and I am 7 years old, and I live in Dallas. The types of things that scared me were the shots.
Now, let's compare that, the types of things that scared her when she was diagnosed and treated for acute lymphoblastic leukemia, ALL. When she was 3, she said she was afraid of the shots. Compare that with Jocelyn Garcia, who was 12 when she was diagnosed with the same thing. And this is what she was more afraid of.
I always feared that I wasn't going to make it. At the time, I was just really worried about staying alive.
You hear a big difference there. You hear a lot more existential type fears and fears about death. Is that right?
Yes. So this is very important when we think about the different ages and stages of cancer in childhood. We have to remember it's almost looking at this as a three-dimensional kind of endeavor, in that not only is it the identity of that human being, but it's also the existence, the existential piece of the young child, as well as the developmental piece. So developmentally, where is that child in terms of their brain functioning, cognitive functioning, mental, emotional, spiritual, social functioning? At the age of 7, that child is still not...
Or 3. She was 3, So even younger.
Right.
Yeah.
So 3 at that time... there are very, very little existential issues of am I going to die? So it's very – it's concrete and visceral, bodily, their fears. The pain of a needle, the pain of going through a bone marrow transplant, the pain of looking at mommy and being scared, like mommy looks scared, I should be scared. It's concrete at that level. Mm-hmm. It's not as abstract. Then you fast forward to a 12-year-old who developmentally is moving into teen years, so that teen angst and angst really is about transitioning in life. Who am I? Why am I here? All the basic existential issues. And what's behind that existential issue is cancer could take my life. And a 12-year-old is better able to understand that just because their brain is more developed and is able to have abstract and formal operational thinking. So in that respect, they're able to grasp the larger picture of things and that I could die from this, as opposed to a 3-year-old who is very much at a level of visceral physical pain.
When does that change start to appear, that idea of this could really take me away mm-hmm. from what I know from this world?
Right. So this is there's an important cognitive developmental psychologist, Jean Piaget, who speaks about the different mental and cognitive stages of a child. And as a child moves from pre-operational stage of a development to concrete operational stage of development, and that's usually around like pre-operational is 3 to 6 years old, and then operational is 7 and up, they're able to really start grasping onto what life and death means, and the abstract notion of death meaning that I'm no longer going to be here anymore, as opposed to a child who doesn't quite grasp that. You know, they have their idea of grandma going to heaven and the fish, you know, going down the toilet bowl, but they don't have an idea of their existence. As a child moves into, let's say, 6, 7, it all depends on where that the child's at, but sometimes even 5, who knows, their brain develops in a way that they're able to capture and understand these more abstract ideas of living and dying, and that my existence is at issue. And that's a powerful shift in cognitive development that really leads into the movement of sort of this existential crisis, right? So cancer is not just I have an ouch and a boo-boo and I have pain, but now it's this could take my life.
Now, at the age, preteen age or teenage, there's a whole bunch of other fears and anxieties that definitely come with a cancer diagnosis. And one thing that Jocelyn, the same girl who was diagnosed when she was 12, describes is how hard it was for her to watch her body change during treatment.
I had long black wavy hair, like down past my shoulders. I was like a size 14, and I went down to like a size 0, like all within like this month span. Like just seeing that happen was very, just kind of traumatizing, especially for like a 12-year-old.
A lot of cancer survivors talk about the way that they look and the scary feeling of looking in the mirror and having lost hair or looking different. Mm-hmm. Why is that so powerful?
Body image is so powerful in pre-adolescence, adolescence, especially now as we're in social media age, Facebook, Instagram. Pictures are so important in our day and age. And your sense of identity is really reflected in how you look. And it's so powerful in terms of one's sense of identity going through, you know, pre-adolescence and adolescence, because it really speaks to belonging. How do I belong in my school environment? How do I belong with my friends? Do I fit in? Fitting in and the psychosocial environment of the young, you know, the pre-adolescent, the adolescent is so potently important to them. And so that long, dark, wavy hair is so powerful to the image of femininity and the movement of her moving into this female body. And then going from a size 14 to a zero is just, what is happening to my body? I'm emaciated. And what does this mean? I am a shadow of myself. And for identity, that is so powerful to witness that in such a short period of time.
Now, at the same time as teens talk about feeling out of place and insecure, years later, you do see oftentimes this growth and maturity. Jocelyn says going bald and being made fun of at school, and it all helped her also realize what beauty is.
If I'm not wearing makeup, if my hair's not done, I'm still going to be nice to you just because I can be a beautiful person without having to look aesthetically pleasing.
And that's such a nice thing to hear. Do you see that growth often?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, cancer really puts your life into full reflection, and all the silliness of what we all think is so important falls away, and we're left with our authenticity. We're left with what is truly important, and the essence of beauty, the essence of truth, that all comes to the forefront when you have an existential crisis like facing cancer. And so to sort of dig deeper into inherent beauty, that beauty comes from the inside out, and to learn those important lessons and messages that we learn later in life.
Yeah, it
to
seems
learn
so
them
early.
Earlier, that's a really important facet of post-traumatic growth. That, yes, cancer can be traumatizing, but there is dimensions of growth, mental, emotional, and spiritual growth that occur that allow a person to live more deeply and truthfully and authentically in life, which is such an important facet of understanding for the cancer experience.
And it can really be a lesson that you learn earlier on,
right,
if you have to go through that so young.
Right. And then also siblings who witness their sister or brother struggling with cancer, they also report being keenly aware of what is essentially important in life, that the money and what you wear and how you look and all that falls away because we still have our sister here and she's still just as beautiful and radiant as ever. Just, you know, she just happens to not have hair and that's okay. It'll grow back.
Which is some of when you see support among family members too of shaving their heads or
right,
doing things to show that you also are going through this with your family or friends.
Right, right. Absolutely.
Now, one of the other things that comes up for preteens is issues with being removed from school, and we'll get more to that. But how is that as a preteen affect kids?
It's very important psychodevelopmentally. I cannot emphasize how important. I had mentioned before Jean Piaget with cognitive development, but Eric Erickson was an important psychosocial developmentalist who really spoke about these issues. So we can talk further about them because it's
okay,
really
important.
Okay,
great. We'll get to that after the break. Right now, we're talking with Shannon Pepito. She's a psycho-oncologist at Baylor's Sammons Cancer Center. This conversation is part of KERA's Breakthroughs series, Growing Up After Cancer, which debuts a week from today. Join our conversation. Call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We'll be back with more from Shannon Pepito after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Summer Youth, with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is now open at smu.edu/summeryouth.
People don't realize that once you're done with cancer, it's not like you say goodbye and walk away. It's with you for the rest of your life. I returned to school full-time in seventh grade when we moved to Texas, and I was doing pretty well. But eighth grade year, I started having major anxiety attacks and just issues focusing in school and taking tests, and it got so bad to the point where my mom actually had to pull me out, and I started homeschooling again.
That was Kyle Freeland, who lives in Tyler. He's 20 now and was diagnosed with cancer when he was 16. Our guest today is Shannon Popito. She's a clinical psychologist and psycho-oncologist, which is a person who deals with the psychology of cancer at Baylor's Sammons Cancer Center. Dr. Popito, thanks for coming in again.
Thank you.
Now, you heard that quote of Kyle Freeland. Is recovering from cancer different than recovering from other illnesses?
Yes and no. I would say yes, it's different because other illnesses don't, again, have that existential sort of facing your mortality piece, right? And so having to face a cancer diagnosis, especially when you're 10, 11, 12 years old, and you have, like we spoke about, this idea of that cancer could kill me. What happens in our body is this fight or flight response, right? It's a protective self-preservatory response, but it triggers the body to be tense and on edge, and the heart races, and a person can develop an anxiety disorder from this sort of fight or flight response, which is natural and normal when facing a very sort of traumatic illness like cancer. So in that respect, cancer has a different challenge to it than another illness that may not potentially have a mortality at the end of it. So, you know, facing death and dying issues and things like that. So it's really important to understand how anxiety pops up and allowing the person to know it's normal to experience anxiety. It's normal to experience anger. It's normal to experience fretting and fear. And it's a part of having to face something as challenging as cancer.
So that anxiety, what do you begin to do with it after, if it persists for years after a treatment? And each case is different because there's always, of course, the possibility of relapse, and you have to be worried about that, but you don't want to be too worried.
Right. Absolutely. So this is, there's gradations of anxiety and fear that people experience. There's normal anxiety where, people will say, I've beat cancer, but every time I go back to my doctor and I have to take a blood test or I get my vitals checked, I get sort of panicky. And the what ifs come in and the fears come in. And that's normal and natural. But when it starts impacting a person's functioning, when it starts impacting a person deciding, I'm not going to go to that party because I might have a panic attack, or I'm not going to go to that social function, or I'm going to stay in the house and avoid, opportunities where I could be engaged, but I get scared. When it starts impacting a person's function, you know, psychosocial functioning, and it occurs for long, extended periods of time, this is where being able to go to a psycho-oncologist like myself, a clinical psychologist that's well-trained in taking care of helping people cope with life transitional stress that goes on with the cancer experience, that's when it would be important for a person to sort of make that choice to connect with their doctor and put them in touch with a psychologist who can help them.
Now, how recent is the idea of a psycho-oncologist, someone who specifically deals with the psychology of cancer? It's a niche that I don't think a lot of people are familiar with.
Yeah, I mean, it's relatively new. I would say over the last 30 years, there's been a lot of work on exploring sort of the effects of cancer on a human being, not just the physiological effects, but the mental, emotional, psychosocial, and spiritual effects of struggling with cancer. And the anxiety, the fears, the anger, the guilt, all that comes with it. And so psychologists are well trained to help people with coping strategies, stress reduction, relaxation, mindfulness, all these different techniques that we have at our disposal, but specifically focused in on cancer. So again, I'm a huge proponent as a psycho-oncologist. I'm always thinking about the existential implications of cancer as opposed to what you had alluded to, any other kind of illness that we have. So this could be an illness that could take my life. And then the developmental implications of a person at different ages and stages of development. And even if they have survived cancer, I still, as an adult psychologist, I still see people coming back. They've survived cancer from teenage years, but they get stuck in developmental issues in their teenage years that they're only now working through in their 40s. And as a psychologist, you well-trained in cancer care, we can help people transition through those challenging periods and become more fully engaged in the world, which is great. So it really does focus in on cancer specifically.
So what does happen for some teenagers who are diagnosed with cancer and go through treatment as a teen? You see some... You said you sometimes see issues come up again from the teenage years later on in life.
Right. And what happens is with some cancer patients to different degrees, but in adolescence, it is such a primary sort of vulnerable time in life, right? Because you're transitioning in so many different ways. Physiologically, you're transitioning into adulthood, mentally, emotionally, trying to figure out who you are, where you're going in life. Some people are even thinking about their careers, their life mates. So there's a lot going on in adolescence. And what happens is cancer is sort of, it can have the capacity of rupturing or fracturing a worldview, where then all of a sudden it's like, whoa, I thought my life was going in this direction, and this just threw me back. And some people are able to sort of work through it and reconcile and make peace with it, and other people get stuck. And that stuckness is really, really important to work through, because if you get stuck in an adolescent ways of dealing with the world, making choices about the world, it's difficult to launch into healthy adulthood, into making purposeful decisions about your career, purposeful decisions about marriage, family, having children, especially if your fertility was put into issue because of the cancer. Yeah. So that is where psychology services can really help. Psycho-oncologists provide cancer-related cognitive behavioral therapy, as well as supportive therapy to help people sort of get unstuck and launch into adult healthy living.
Does research show that cancer does increase a kid's risk of post-traumatic stress disorder?
There is research out there on cancer-related post-traumatic stress disorder, definitely. And there are definitely vulnerabilities, people that are a little bit more susceptible to post-traumatic stress from cancer. And some of those what research has explored are some of the more striking predispositions are if you already experienced some sort of traumatic stress in your life prior to cancer, that'll leave you a little more vulnerable and susceptible to post-traumatic stress disorder. Some other ones are avoidance coping strategies. So people that avoid having to cope, and if that's their regular disposition to avoid through drinking, smoking, drinking, drugs, avoiding social interactions, any sort of thing like that, that'll leave you susceptible. Other research has shown that certain socioeconomic status, interestingly enough, African-American women are a little bit more susceptible. So there are different vulnerabilities in populations. There's actually new research out on genetic predisposition to post-traumatic stress. So if you have a predisposition and then you get cancer, then that leaves you a little bit more vulnerable. But again, every human being is different. Every person takes up their life experience differently. And one person can be really struck by post-traumatic stress, whereas another can sort of find their way through the experience in a more resilient way.
And how about for parents? I know that parents I've spoken with for the series, the Growing Up After Cancer series, some have told me that they also experience high anxiety around bringing their kid in for another checkup.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of great research on vicarious post-traumatic stress. Mm. And that is when somebody witnesses another, a loved one or another human being suffer. And that sort of vicarious component is so powerful in a family dynamic when they're consistently watching their child suffer through long drawn out bone marrow transplant or through all the different treatments, chemotherapy, radiation, surgery, to witness a loved one, especially a child that you've given birth to, experience such pain and suffering can also trigger post-traumatic stress in the form of anxiety, even depression. If they feel that they don't know how to handle the situation, that can affect family members as well.
Now, even though childhood cancer can be extremely stressful, and like we talked about, parents can also feel it that way, there are some positive effects, possible positive effects. Mm-hmm. And a study I saw at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital showed kids reported benefits like developing greater empathy and growing closer to family and friends. And that was certainly the case that we saw with one family here in Plano that's going to be featured in our series. Older brother Joshua describes when he's now 17, but he was 12 when his younger brother got cancer.
I think that after he got out of the hospital, we really did become closer. It's hard to explain how exactly, but it's just kind of a feeling that I just can tell. And I think that after you see someone who you love, you know, about to die and, you know, go through these really difficult times where you don't know whether you'll see them ever again, I think you just really have to become closer after.
Now, Dr. Pepito, do you often see siblings and families come closer like this?
Yes,
cancer?
Absolutely. I see variations of getting of becoming very close and tight knit, and we've been through the war and the struggle together. I've also seen the other sort of shadow of it, where families have really struggled with finding a new normal, and really struggled with the dynamics in the family. But specifically for this scenario, so powerful. I have three sisters, mm-hmm. and witnessing any sort of struggle, again, it really deepens the relationship because you're in it for the long haul with them, and you want to sort of go through the fire with them. And so when they come out the other side, it's an achievement for the entire family. It is a rebirth and a resurgence with the entire family sort of witnessing powerful aspects of the human story in ways that they wouldn't have had if they didn't have this glimpse into it through sort of the portal of cancer.
And what happens, what can cause it to go the other direction for a family to actually fall apart?
Right. I mean, there's a myriad of different reasons. I think that if a family's already struggling, let's say there's divorce in the family or there's discord in the family or there's sibling rivalry in the family, which we've all experienced. So if there's discord in any way and there's a sense of uprootedness and not a sense of real solidity in the family prior to cancer diagnosis, you're really working on shaky ground when a young child gets diagnosed with cancer, because the distress tolerance in the family is so low because they don't have that solid grounding that it develops more and more turmoil, and it can go in a different direction after the child finally comes through the cancer, where very often I see as a psychologist, marriages break up, there's divorce, there's sort of the siblings go their different directions, or there's sort of this uncomfortable silence in the home. Nobody wants to talk about the big C cancer. And but there are gradations in this, and I truly believe I've seen some beautiful work done where families go to family therapy and they're able to share their experience, their collective shared experience of cancer, and it really does bring a family back together again.
So family therapy is one way. What other things can families do who are going through a cancer diagnosis together and know that this is maybe just happened to prepare for that as a family?
Right. So family therapy is very a good marriage and family therapist is the best bet, because these practitioners are really focused on the entire family dynamic. And there's an art and science to a marriage family therapist approach, because they're not just looking at that one child who had cancer, but they're looking at how the constellation of relationships occur in that family, in the sense of who's got the power, who feels vulnerable, who feels that they have a sense of belonging, who feels like the outcast. And all of that is so powerful in family therapy, to allow everyone to have a voice and to have people share their story in the family that for whatever reason have been silenced because cancer has taken a larger role in the family. And so now they'll have a voice to really share what they've been struggling with, even though they weren't the ones who had cancer.
Now, we're talking today with Dr. Shannon Pepito. She's a psycho-oncologist at Baylor's Sammons Cancer Center. This conversation is a part of Breakthroughs Project at KERA, Growing Up After Cancer. The series debuts a week from today. Join our conversation now by calling 800-933-5372, emailing think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet. I'm @LSilverwoman. We'll be back with more from Dr. Shannon Pepito after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is now open at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. Our guest is Dr. Shannon Pepito. She's a clinical psychologist and psycho-oncologist at Baylor's Sammons Cancer Center. What's it take for a kid to get back to normal after cancer?
Oh, that's a good question, because every child is different and every child has a different disposition and a different way of moving in the world and how they connect with others. So this is where I really, as a psychologist, I track meaning and purpose for patients. No matter what the age, I always want to gauge what is most meaningful to this person, what is most purposeful to this person. So meaning has to do with love. What do I love in this world? Who do I love in this world? My family, my siblings, my friends at school, my friends on the block. I play kickball with certain friends. Purpose is, what do I do to allow me to feel that I belong? So when we get older, we think about our career. How do I belong in what I do? But loving and, doing have to be well sort of married together. So when I help patients to sort of overcome or you know, find their new normal in cancer, I'm always trying to connect with what makes them tick. What is it that will make you take two steps into the world and really re-engage with the world again on your terms? Not on everybody else's terms, but really what will plug you back into life. And the way that we plug back into life is through meaning and purpose. So that's the best way to help people.
Bill is calling from Fort Worth. He's a cancer survivor. Bill, are you on the line?
I am. I want to pass on a couple of strategies that I found to be successful in my dealing with cancer. I was diagnosed in 95, and I'm fine today. One thing that grips you is fear. And I'm sure what I'm about to say applies to children as well as adults. And it really helps to understand what your options are, that you're not fated to die, that there are a lot of options out there. And the great this has to do with a lot with cognitive behavioral therapy, your state of mind, but also expectancy theory, the hope that in the future there's going to be breakthroughs that are going to help you. But a big thing, especially for children, I believe, is that you have this problem with not feeling like you belong, like almost like you're a mutant, a freak. And what I've discovered after a lot of study is that out of the trillions of cells in our body, there are some that mutate the wrong way. So in a sense, everyone has cancer. And what we have to do is not feel like we're different. We're just like everybody else. And it's a matter of degree. Some, of course, have metastasized, but others, I mean, everybody, I think, is walking around with some cancerous cells in their body. But your immune system hopefully can find it and deal with it, and that's another strategy, immunotherapy. Mm-hmm. But the big thing is to know this is sort of like a normalization of deviancy. You understand that you're off course, but so is everybody else. You're not that freakish.
Bill, thank you so much. That's a great comment. And it's true. It's true what he's saying from the doctors I spoke with for the series. Really, everyone, they think now, does sometimes have cancer, and their immune systems just fight it off. And it's not that abnormal to have abnormal cells.
Right, right. I mean, it is our cellular makeup is essentially generative and regenerative, right? So it is the wellspring of what gives us life is our cellular makeup. And yes, and when some of these cells go awry, almost like sheep in a pasture, you know, there are ways, thankfully, so much great research has been going, you know, really being focused in, especially in the last 50 to 100 years, on really focusing in on genetic as well as cellular, you know, cellular components of cancer and eradicating the mutated ones. But I think what the caller, a point that he made that I think is really important too, two of which, belonging, that, you know, you're not an alien, you're not some creature, you know, that has all of a sudden become diagnosed and now you're no longer human. You're all too human. You're even more aware of your humanity through the cancer. But also the power of being able to balance knowledge is really, really important. So understanding that anticipatory anxiety, anticipating the what ifs, oh my gosh, I'm going to go into the doctor, he's going to, you know, the cancer's going to come back. All that anticipatory anxiety can be reduced by relaxing your body, relaxation, breathing techniques, mindfulness, all that cognitive behavioral therapy is very, very important. And then also preparatory planning, so that expectation management. Like I need to take care of myself. So there's a component of healthy lifestyle. There's a component of taking care of myself. That if I need to be mindful of what I'm putting in this body to feed my regenerative cells. My cells want to regenerate, and I need a good immune functioning, a robust immune functioning, to allow my cells to do the work that they're meant to do. So healthy eating, healthy exercise, healthy socialization, healthy amount of information on the internet, which means whatever helps you to feel that you're understanding the cancer that's in your body to a level that mitigates the fear is good. When you overdose, the Googling and the PubMed searching and the Medline searching is when you start exacerbating an anxiety and a worry that does not need to be there. So again, you have to come back to mindfulness. Am I taking care of myself by gaining this knowledge? If I'm taking care of myself and it's making me feel empowered and knowledgeable, great. If it's making me feel angsty and fearful and impeding my sleep, I have to put a boundary on it, a limit on it.
Now, there's been lots of breakthroughs in cancer treatment over the past even a few years in terms of research on immunotherapy, and that's where you can engineer your own cells to actually fight cancer cells, things that they're working on. Does everyone see these types of exciting new drugs and treatments on the horizon with the same anticipation? Does it help people who are scared about their future cope with what's happening now?
Mm-hmm. Again, freedom and knowledge within limits. So if this particular caller finds it helpful and reduces the stress by looking online and seeing, oh, look at this growing research out there on immunotherapies. This is so important. This is building my knowledge skill set. If that works for him or works for people, again, every human being is different and everybody deals with stressors, especially medical stressors, differently. I'm a huge proponent myself of engaging the patient in what is in their hands and what is outside of their hands. So to take care of yourself, you need to know what is in your hands. What is in your hands is, I have the capacity to take care of myself by being mindful of what I put in my body, lowering processed refined sugars, lowering any sort of high sodium, high sugars, high, whites, processed foods, all that kind of stuff, because you want your immune functioning to be working for you. And so you're in your own way, you are making a mindful decision to eat the right foods, exercise, even though your body's saying, I'm so fatigued and tired, I can't do it. Get out there and take a walk around the block, preferably with somebody that, a friend, a loved one, your husband, your child. But again, psychosocial connection as well boosts the immune functioning. So that's what's in your hands. And what's out of your hands, unless you're a researcher who is actually actively involved in these, NCI research studies, you can follow them. You can follow the research studies and see what's out there for you. But it's not really in your hands, unless you're the scientist, to worry about launching that stuff. So really focusing in on, what can I do to take care of myself? That is primary in cancer care.
We're talking with Dr. Shannon Popito about the growing up after cancer and some of the psychological effects of a cancer diagnosis. You can call 1-800-933-5372 to get a comment in, or you can email think@kera.org. Now, one of the people we spoke with for our series, Growing Up After Cancer, Desiree Smith, she talks about going back to school after being treated at Cook Children's in Fort Worth for leukemia.
Whenever I went back to school, I had to start all over again. And it was pretty hard for me because it still kind of is, because the teachers don't seem to understand what's the actual problem, even though that they don't see any physical illnesses. They think, oh, she's okay, but deep down inside there could be so much going on and they don't know what's happening.
She's 16 years old now. What should teachers and schools be doing to help kids who've recovered physically from cancer return to class and emotionally be okay?
Right. That's a great question. You know, I always come back to a new normal and normalizing the cancer experience. And I think, you know, teachers have a really, I mean, I remember my third grade teacher, Mrs. King, and I just thought the sun and the moon, the stars, whatever she thought about me, I took that in my own sort of personal identity. And so moving, you know, really working with children in, with a sense of, and I know most teachers do this, a sense of compassion, a sense of empathy, working also in, you know, in continuum between the child and the family structure, which is really important to keep everybody in the loop. Engaging, I think, you know, children do best in routines. Routine is so important. So what they understand about school is I have first period, second period, third period, I have lunch, I get to hang out with my friends, and I get to go to recess and hang out with my friends and go to gym and all this. And so there's that social environment of school. But then there's also that cognitive environment where a child who's been sort of taken out of school for a semester or a year because of bone marrow transplant or because of some cancer treatment, they will be struggling a little bit more behind cognitively processing because they've had this window of opportunity where they weren't building into their brains and building into their sort of cognitive structures. We also have to remember psychosocially, you know, middle school is all about industry versus inferiority. That's Eric Erickson's psychosocial stage of development. I'm always returned back to it because it's so important. Industry is all about a sense of competence and a sense of adequacy and a sense of look at me, look what I can do. I can do these multiplications tables just like everyone else. But if you've had chemo treatment and you have and you're struggling with chemo brain, you may not, that's quote unquote chemo brain.
Which are side effects from some of the drugs, which can make it harder to remember things.
100%. So short-term memory, being able to cognitively process things as quickly and as adept as your counterpart who's sitting next to you. And so the teachers need to be sort of aware of that. And if they have any questions, I think it would be great if they can reach out to there's always child life specialists at cancer hospitals. And child life specialists are great with this because they can do brief sort of psychosocial interventions with teachers to bring them up to speed on this is where the child is at this age. This is where they are cognitively and socially. This is what they need. This is how you can bolster their experience in school and allow them to feel normalized, allow them to feel that sense of routine, but also be aware of some of the ways that they might be a little bit behind behind their counterparts, and how maybe tutorials and things like that can tutors can help them.
Our guest today was Dr. Shannon Pepito with Baylor's Sammons Cancer Center. Thank you so much for coming in.
Absolutely.
Make sure to tune in a week from today for KERA's Breakthrough series, Growing Up After Cancer. It debuts next Wednesday during Morning Edition. There will also be a screening of the PBS documentary Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies, on March 19th at KERA. RSVP at kera.org.